This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Skywatchers across the globe are hoping for clear skies next Monday, hoping to catch a rare astronomical event, the transit of Mercury. No, I'm not talking about some astrology thing here. You want to watch it yourself? Here to tell us about the transit and other things we can see if we keep looking up is Dean Regas. He's the outreach astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory and co-host of the PBS program Stargazers. Talking today with us from WVXU in Cincinnati. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dean.
My pleasure. Good afternoon.
What is the transit of Mercury all about?
I know, it's a cool-sounding name, that's
it.
For sure. This is the tiny planet Mercury. It's going to come between us and the sun on Monday, most of the day, between 7:12 a.m. Eastern Daylight to 2:42 p.m. So it's a 7.5-hour event where Mercury will just show itself as a little dot going across the surface of the sun, like a miniature eclipse.
So anybody, when the sun is up, can see it on Monday?
Exactly. So if you're on the East Coast, you can see it just after the sun rises, right at 7:12. If you're on the West Coast, you're going to have to wait a little while. It'll already be starting. The transit will have already started by the time the sun rises for you guys out west. But at some point in the day, everybody in the United States would be able to see it. Most of Europe, South America, Africa, almost the entire world gets to see it, other than if you're in Australia and New Zealand.
All right. They'll see the next one.
Yeah, they'll get the next one. 3 more years, they'll get the next
They'll get the next one. But we all know you just can't look at the sun, right?
That's right. That's right. Well, Mom always told me, Dean, never stare at the sun. But now that I became an astronomer, I can do that. I've got special filters that you can put on the end of telescopes or binoculars to be able to see it. There's two parts to this that you have to do. One, you have to use safe solar viewers. And two, you're going to have to magnify the image. So that means pinhole cameras and eclipse glasses, just looking at it, you won't see it. Mercury is that small compared to the sun. So we're talking a planet that's about 3,000 miles in diameter going in front of a star 865,000 miles in diameter.
Can you make a home little jiggy to see it?
My favorite way to do it is use a pair of binoculars. And you project an image of the sun. So you let the sunlight come through the binoculars. You cover one of the oculars, I guess you call it. You cover one of them. Let light come through just the other part of the binoculars. Project it onto a white piece of paper. You can even focus it using the focuser on the binoculars.
Yeah.
And you throw the image about a few feet down, and you'll see an image of the sun. You can see sunspots on it. You can see, hopefully, even the little spot of Mercury. So as long as you don't put your eye, your hand, or your leg or something into the beam, you're safe.
Why is this such a rare event?
Well, to get everything just lined up perfectly is pretty tough. I mean, Mercury from us is pretty far. It's about 60 million miles from us, and then it's another 36 million miles from the sun. And it's so small, it has to just line up perfectly for all three of our bodies to be just so. And so it goes in these seasons. You can have a transit of Mercury around May 9th or in November, right around November 10th or November 11th. Those are the transit seasons where it crosses the nodes. It's kind of like an eclipse. Like eclipses are rare for the same reason, but these are even more rare. A couple years ago, we had a transit of Venus.
Right.
And those are, we get two of those every 100 years. And so Mercury is at least a little more often. We get about 13 to 14 every century.
So this is not really terribly scientific. It's just a really cool thing to watch.
Well, exactly. And this is one of those things that this is, for me, this is what makes science so cool, is that if you're out there, you're walking around normally, you would not notice anything different. The sun will be the same. The light will be the same. Nothing will be happening. But we're so smart that we can actually time this stuff, that we know exactly when Mercury is going to go across the sun. And with just a little bit of equipment, you can kind of see this. And I'm very excited because the last one was 10 years ago and I got clouded out. So I'm hoping, fingers are crossed, that this one's going to be good.
No, we have a lot of bad weather here in the east and we're hoping that we get to see it also. Is there something that ancient astronomers were able to see? Did they write about this?
Well, this is a relatively new understanding because the first transit of Mercury that was ever seen was in 1631. An astronomer named Pierre Cassendi saw it. And he, just the year before, he read this book by Kepler that said, okay, everybody, look at the sun on this day in 1631. You might see Mercury going in front of it. Kepler since died before that, so he never got to see it himself, but Gassendi did, and this was huge back then because nobody could predict things that accurately, and Kepler's tables were by far the best. This proved that his view of the universe was right, that everything went around the sun and everything went around ellipses, and we could now predict things with such great accuracy.
And this sort of is a down-to-earth, so to speak, demonstration of how exoplanet hunters look for planets, right? This is basically
exactly
the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. There's that spacecraft called the Kepler spacecraft. Another Kepler here. We'll throw that in. This is looking at stars and looking for planets crossing in front of their stars. So it's like they're looking for transits of Mercury, except there are other stars. And when this went up, I thought, are you kidding me? I mean, we hardly have transits here. We have them every, you know, very rarely. Are we going to find planets transiting stars? And I'm happy to say we found over 1,000 of them this way. We're looking at other stars. We could see Jupiter-sized planets go in front of their star, Neptune-sized planets, and now we're seeing even Earth and Mars-sized planets going in front of their stars.
Speaking of Mars, what other planets are up now that would be worth going out to see?
Oh, well, we're in Jupiter season right now, so that's the star-like thing you see up at nighttime that's really, really bright.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like suspiciously bright.
I saw it near the moon the other day. It was really close.
Oh, that's the best. And that's when we get our calls at the Cincinnati Observatory. They say, what was that thing next to the moon? Oh, my gosh. And we're like, well, it's Jupiter. And they're like, okay, that's still cool. So in the next couple weeks, once we get into June, we get Mars season coming where Mars will be at its best. We celebrate, we call it Marsapalooza when that happens. It's end of May. And then we have our Marsapalooza celebration. That's going to be June 11th. That's when, pick a Saturday night when the moon, I think the moon will be next to us. So we got it all set up. And because people go really crazy about Mars, we've had events at the observatory back in 2003 when Mars was at its closest. We had about 1,500 people showed up. We had lines down the street. People wanted to look through the telescope at Mars and look for Martians or something like that. I don't know. And then we
War
had
of the
Saturn
world's
coming
time,
up.
You know.
Oh, I know. People love Mars. It's one of those things. I think it's in our psyche. We want to know a lot more about it. And so that'll be in June. And then we got Saturn coming up too, which its rings are going to be tilted more towards us. So we're going to see it, that picturesque picture of Saturn in our telescopes coming up.
I got to pull out my 30-year-old Celestron and see if I can
see. Oh, that'll work. That'll work.
And any meteor showers coming up?
Well, we're in the midst of one right now, actually. We had one that peaked this morning / till tomorrow morning. It's called the Eta Aquarids, not one of the most popular ones. But it's these are meteors that originated from Halley's Comet. The comet went by. It left its tail behind, parts of its tail behind, and now the Earth is running into it. So I had a few friends that stayed up last night and this morning. They saw some really good ones.
Oh, really?
They saw some really bright fireballs. One friend of mine even saw one that was so bright it cast a shadow.
No,
and
come
that
on.
Was, I know.
Was there any imbibing going on?
I'm not sure. I need to talk to him, but I'm just doing my hearsay.
Yeah.
I'm a notoriously bad a meteor watcher. Whenever I go out, they're always never good. They're never good. I mean, the reports are saying you can see 30 to 50 an hour shooting across the sky. Best time is between like 2 and 3 a.m., but I kind of laugh at those numbers because whenever I go look at meteor showers, I see 2 or 3 and that's it. But
yeah.
Hopefully. But one of these days, I might get lucky and get to see a real good one.
Yeah. What's it called? The Eta?
Eta Aquarids. So they're coming, they look like they radiate out of the constellation Aquarius.
And it's bits of Halley's Comet, left over from Halley's Comet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you get to see parts of Halley's Comet since we won't see the big body of it until 2061. So we get to see the little leftover parts.
So when somebody points to the sky and say, hey, look, it's Halley's Comet trying to distract you, it really will be.
Well, that's a good one. I have to use that. That's a good one, Ira. I like that.
I can't remember what movie that's from. And if you can't get your solar viewer, you know, if you can't get out there to see the sun and get your viewer working on your own, you can watch it online, right?
Yes, most definitely. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of live streaming of the event. I know Sky and Telescope magazine's going to be doing one. And this is a pretty exciting stuff. And what we're really taking this one on, this is our practice. This is This transit is our practice for what I'm calling the big one. On August 21st next year, 2017, we have the total solar eclipse. Oh my gosh, I've been waiting for this since I started teaching astronomy 18 years ago.
My daughter Anna said 5 years ago, we're going to see this one.
Yeah. Oh, it's only a year away.
Where do you go?
Wait.
I mean, you need to find some place where you're pretty sure there are going to be no clouds that day, right?
Exactly.
Where's a good spot?
Well, so you can be anywhere on the strip of land between Oregon and South Carolina for that eclipse. But the best weather forecast is Wyoming, Nebraska. The longest period of the eclipse is going to be in Kentucky. So as long as you find a clear spot, it's going to be pretty much the same. I'm planning on going to St. Louis, watching the weather, and driving east or west depending on what the forecast is. That's my plan.
Because you could maybe outrun a storm or some clouds or something.
Exactly. I'm a certified eclipse chaser, Ira. I've had success the last four lunar eclipses. I caught all four of them. All of them I had to chase because of clouds. And whew, I just barely made this one. Oh my gosh, it was close.
Now, we're going to talk more about this one because
it is the big one because it's an all-American eclipse, and I think we're going to have a lot of people seeing it.
And you could just pull off a highway and sit there, right? You don't have to go to any special place.
Exactly. And this is—it's not like it's an all-day event. You just be in the right place at the right time for. I think the maximum eclipse is going to be 2 minutes and 31 seconds. You get there for that 2 minutes and 31 seconds will change your life. That's
right.
For sure. I've seen one, and whew, it's great.
Sign me up. All right, Dean. Thanks a lot.
We'll meet in Kentucky. How about that?
Okay. I'm on for this one. Dean Regas.
All right.
Outreach astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory, co-host of a PBS program, Stargazers. Thank you, Dean. We'll see
My
you.
My pleasure.
We'll
Thanks,
see you next year, if not before.
Looking up.
Yep. When we come back, why is major weight loss so hard to maintain for many people? A new study at the struggles of people who lost huge amounts of weight the contestants on The Biggest Loser. We're going to have one with us and talk about why it's so difficult to keep that weight loss after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you've ever watched the reality TV show The Biggest Loser, you know that those contestants put in a gargantuan effort to lose weight. They diet rigorously, they exercise for many hours a day, and they compete with each other to completely change their bodies. And many do change their bodies, some losing 100, 200, or more pounds in a very short period of time. But what happens after the cameras, the coaches, and the cuisine pack up? It turns out that, like many people who lose weight, maintaining that smaller frame is hard, even for those who were so successful at achieving it in the first place. Now, a new study of the show contestants has found that most of them have gained weight in the 6 years since, and some of them had gained back most or even all of what they lost. And what surprised the researchers, though, was this, that while a drop in metabolism after the initial weight loss was expected, every participant's metabolism remained much slower than it should be for someone their size, despite the passage of time. So what's going on here? Does the body want to return to its former weight? What does this mean for anyone who's unhappy with their current weight? And what does this mean for the hard emotional work put in by the Biggest Loser contestants themselves? We're going to discuss it and take your stories. If you'd like to give us your battle with weight, what's going on with you, whether you lose or you maintain it, what has the process been like? Was it worth the effort? Our number is 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Now, let me introduce my guests. Kevin Hall is a researcher with the NIH's National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Disease. He is the lead author of the study, which appeared in Obesity earlier this week. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Hall.
Thanks for having me.
Dina Mercado was a contestant in the show's eighth season and a participant in Dr. Hall's study. Welcome to Science Friday, Dina.
Thank you for having me also.
You're welcome. Dr. Hall, how much reality television do you watch anyway?
My wife doesn't like how much reality TV I watch, but in this case, maybe it actually worked out for the benefit of science.
So what gave you the idea to study the contestants on The Biggest Loser?
Right. Well, actually, I came home from the lab late one night, turned on the television and saw people stepping on scales at the end of a previous season of The Biggest Loser, and I couldn't believe how much weight they were losing. It was dramatic amounts. And so, you know, this was my field of study, and I figured I should be able to understand what's going on. And so I eventually contacted the physician in charge of their care at The Biggest Loser and started chatting with them about, well, what's happening to these folks' metabolism? How much fat are they losing versus lean tissue? And these kinds of questions. And we basically collaborated initially on a study that was published several years ago about what was happening to their metabolic rate and their body composition as they lost weight. And now, 6 years later, we did this follow-up study on 14 of those 16 original subjects.
Okay, so you followed up with them 6 years after they lost weight. And what did you discover?
Yeah, so as you mentioned in the introduction, we were very surprised by the fact that despite regaining a substantial quantity of the weight that they'd lost, their resting metabolic rate, that's the number of calories their body is burning in order to just basically maintain life, was still at this very low level that we observed at the end of the weight loss period on average, and much less, about 500 calories a day less than would be expected for their newer, slightly higher body size. So this means that they're at some sort of disadvantage in terms of trying to keep the weight off. And so we weren't that surprised that folks had regained the weight. We sort of expected that. Most people who lose a lot of weight will regain some of it back. But what we were most surprised by was the persistent slowing of metabolism that was observed in these folks.
And you have no idea why that would continue.
Yeah, I mean, I think we don't know if it was something that was a result of this rapid weight loss that they experienced early on as part of the competition. What we do know is that everybody experiences this sort of metabolic slowing to some extent when they try to lose weight, especially in the early time period. And what we think that we're able to show here is that just how strong that can be when you look at extreme weight loss like these folks have experienced. I don't think that everyday folks will experience either this extreme amount of weight loss or this metabolic slowdown that these folks experienced in a quantitative sense, but they will experience it to a smaller degree.
Dina, what did you do during the show to lose so much weight so quickly? You lost 75 pounds?
Yeah, actually, it was 80.
80? How much work did that take? Describe for us.
Oh, a whole lot of work. It was several hours. The typical person goes to work for, you know, an eight-hour day, and just like that, we were pretty much, that was our job, and we worked out from 8 to 9 hours a day just overall with the trainer, and they would leave us homework, and we'd continue to work out, and then, you know, meals in between, of course, and snacks in between, of course, but at the end of the day, you still wanted to work out even past those 8 hours and 9 hours because of the fact that it was still a game and you wanted to do more than the next person, you know, that was sitting next to you or, you know, so on and so forth. So you just, it was about, I want to say, 9 to 10 hours a day, depending on, you know, your personal preference, just to stay that week longer.
Wow. And so when your weight returned, you must have been devastated.
Absolutely. I mean, you don't do that to gain weight back. And so, you know, as it started to crawl on, it was just kind of like, you know, what's going on? I was able to maintain for a little while, for about 2 years. I did become pregnant after a while, but I was able to get, you know, a lot of that off. And then I got pregnant again, and I was able to, and at that point, that's where I began to see things change, because even though I was doing what I did the first time to begin to lose, the second time after that second pregnancy, I was doing the same thing to try to get back down to that weight that I had maintained after my finale, and it wasn't working the same. And it was just kind of like, wait a minute, why did it work, you know, at one point, and now it's not working anymore? And so that's kind of where I'm at. And you know, it didn't, and all this makes sense now, because it's like, wow, I didn't realize that I had to burn that many more calories on top of what I was doing when it worked, you know, previously before.
Yeah, because your metabolism slowed down.
Correct, and I didn't realize that. I didn't know that, so it makes sense. So when we did the study and Dr. Hall came out with these results, it was like, wow, I get it. You know, now that I know what I know, I can begin to adjust either what I put in my mouth and my intake, or adjust, you know, just working out even more to be able to get back or to try to lose again or even try to maintain what I have at this point.
So you could eat less, fewer calories, and still not take the weight off.
Well, I am, you know, that's kind of where we're at, I guess, at this point is I'm trying to, right now I'm eating between, you know, I'm trying to stay between the 1,400 and 1,500 calories, and now I kind of feel like I have to drop, but at the same time, you know, if I drop another 500 calories, I'm almost eating nothing.
Right.
So it's either I have to do that and to try to kind of either lose or even maintain, or I have to just work out more or be more active than what I am right now. And to be quite honest with you, with two little ones and trying to get to the gym at least three times a week and whatnot, it's difficult. You know, it's difficult to do that. So, but at the same time, I don't want to see this number go up anymore.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Hall, we, as someone who works out a little bit, and I know I'm trying to maintain my muscle mass as I get older, the rule of thumb has always been, well, if you work out, you're going to build up more muscle, and more muscle will burn more efficiently, will burn calories. Did that not happen here?
Yeah, so it's an interesting point, and this is a bit of mythology that our original study busted, actually, because these folks who are doing a lot of just tons of exercise, right, an unrealistically unsustainable amount of exercise during their weight loss competition, were actually able to maintain their lean body mass and their muscle much better than would be expected for the amount of weight that they lost. In fact, one of the things that we did was we compared those folks with people who lost weight, a similar amount of weight, by another means, which is one of these bariatric surgeries, and they lost quite a bit of muscle. The surprising thing was that despite that preservation of muscle, their metabolic rate slowed down much more than would be expected, several hundred calories a day more than would be expected. And in hindsight, when you actually look at the physiology of muscle, muscle actually doesn't burn that many calories at rest. We're talking about 15 calories per day for every kilogram of muscle, so it's 2.2 pounds of muscle. And people don't generally change their muscle by more than a kilogram or so when you're trying to work out and gain weight, unless you're a bodybuilder. And even then, it's not that many calories at rest. So that's a little bit of mythology that still persists out there in the sort of exercise and fitness communities.
You know, there are some scientists like Robert Lustig who have suggested that the body has a set weight that it wants to stick to, and the brain and the metabolism will make adjustments, whatever you do, to go to that weight where it wants to be. Do you agree with that research?
You know, we found some evidence for that in these particular subjects, actually. So, for example, one of the perhaps counterintuitive findings that we obtained was that the people who had actually had the most success at maintaining the weight loss were the folks who actually were experiencing the greatest metabolic slowing. So they were burning the fewest number of calories. And the way we like to think about it is that the body is kind of behaving like a spring. And you can pull on the spring and intervene by dieting and exercising, and you're able to stretch the spring out and analogously lose weight. But the harder the spring is going to pull back on you. And so the folks who are most successful are pulling the hardest on the spring and stretching it out the most, but they're also the ones that are experiencing the greatest pullback. And so that sort of goes along with what you're saying, that the body has a sort of preferred weight that it would like to maintain, and your efforts to change from that weight are met with some resistance.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can go to the phones right now. Got a couple of calls in. Let's go to Buford, South Carolina. And Todd, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Hi there. Go ahead.
2 years ago, September, I had one of the bariatric surgeries, and I was able to go from a little over 330 pounds to about 115 pounds. And since then, you get, they say, a honeymoon period of about a year where you don't have much of an appetite, but it about a calendar year, your appetite comes back, and it's been a real fight to keep the weight off.
Yeah. Bariatric surgery, Dr. Hall?
Yeah, so the caller mentions bariatric surgery, and I'd mentioned previously that folks who undergo bariatric surgery, unless they also do some exercise or change their diet in some way to maybe perhaps increase protein intake, will lose some of this lean mass. which will tend to slow metabolism. But one of the interesting things that we found when we compared matched bariatric surgery subjects with the Biggest Loser contestants was that they also experienced the metabolic slowing within the first year, but after that, very interestingly, that that greater than expected change in metabolic rate went away. In other words, their metabolism normalized after a year of bariatric surgery. But that was obviously not the case in the Biggest Loser contestants. There might be some sort of resetting of the quote-unquote set point with some of these bariatric surgeries. But the caller's right. I mean, your appetite will also go up over time, and you will eat more food following the initial stages of the bariatric surgery. But what we know is that right now, those are the only persistent, long-term, reproducible kinds of interventions that we can do to lead to long-term weight loss in people. And we're really trying to understand the biology of what's responsible for the relative success of bariatric surgery compared to the lifestyle interventions that we're all familiar with.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Kevin Hall, who's the lead author of a study which appeared in Obesity earlier this week, and with Tina Mercado, who was a contestant in the show's eighth season and a participant in Dr. Hall's study. Tina, are you sorry now after all this? Were you sorry for going on the program now that you lost the weight and it seems like a nightmare trying to keep it off?
It's pretty discouraging. You know, that's the truth. However, you know, I can't really regret doing this whole thing, and the reason I say that, and pretty much I guess the only reason I say that is because I initially went on the Biggest Loser to be healthy, of course, and in becoming healthy, I wanted to bear more children, and I have had two children. You know, I would like to say because of the weight that I've lost, and so I can't completely regret doing what I'm doing. However, what I will say is if somebody came up to me or called me or whatever and asked me my opinion on, you know, being the next contestant possibly on another season or so, I would strongly discourage them to do so knowing the findings now. And so that's kind of where I sit with it. I kind of, you know, sat and thought about it, and I said, you know, I can't regret it at this point. Now I am where I am. I do have three children altogether now, but now, you know, what's next for me and what can I do to either, you know, either try to, you know, find a way for us to reverse what's going on or to just obviously burn less calories or eat less or, you know, figure something out. Because like I said, that's my biggest fear is what's my metabolism going to do? You know, where am I going to be at in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now? And so that's where I kind of sit with it. And it's just, what can I change at this point that I'm here? I can't go backward, obviously. And so now it's just trying to figure out what to do now.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Hall, there's sort of a growing movement by activists who emphasize health at any size and encouraging people to focus on healthy habits without regard for the numbers on the scale. Do you agree with this philosophy?
You know, I do in the following sense. You know, I think a lot of people conflate the cosmetics of weight loss with the health benefits. You don't actually have to lose the sort of Biggest Loser style amounts of weight in order to improve your health. And in fact, one of the things that I would stress is very important for people to come away with this as a message for not necessarily targeting these very unrealistic and unsustainable amounts of weight loss. If you can change your diet and eat healthier foods and add some exercise in your life, not crazy amounts like the Biggest Loser does on the program, you're going to see independent health benefits regardless of your weight. And if you make those changes and make them in a sustainable way, a way that you can actually keep them and integrate them within your life over the long term, you know, your weight will settle at a different value, or it might not settle at a different value, but regardless, your health will be improved.
Well, we want to thank next interesting stories. Dina, thank you for sharing that with us and your trials. We wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Dina Mercado is a former contestant on The Biggest Loser and a participant in Dr. Kevin Hall's study. He's a researcher at NIH's National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Disease and the author of the study on the physiology of weight loss and maintenance. Thank you, Dr. Hall, for joining us also.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a break, and when we come up, we're going to talk about how to catch an elusive critter on a camera. Well, how about laying a trap? I don't mean a physical trap. You're not going to grab it. This is going to be a camera trap, sort of an animal selfie. If you've got one and you want to tell us about it, catching a selfie for yourself in a camera trap, give us a call, 844-724-8255. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Every day, I go out to check my deck. I'm looking for the bulbs I've planted in the pots, the newly planted ones. And more times than not, some squirrel has dug through the pot, spewing soil all over. And each day, after swearing words unsuitable for broadcast, I think, I wish I could catch that thief in the act. In fact, my yard is full of life, deer, rabbits, even a few turkeys, not to mention the birds at my feeder. And what I need is something that scientists and citizen scientists alike are turning to, the camera trap. This is not something you actually physically catch animals in. It's a device that takes pictures of even the most camera-shy critter. And here to explain how camera traps work and why they are research tools is Roland Kays. He's a camera trapper, a zoologist. He's head of the Biodiversity Research Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Sciences in Raleigh. And he put together for us a best of camera trap pictures in his new book called Candid Creatures. And if you have a camera trap and you want to tell us about it, give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. And we welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Kays.
Great. Thanks for having me. It's exciting to be here.
Yeah. Maybe I can catch a picture of those squirrels at work. How does the average camera trap work?
Well, it's pretty simple, really. It's a motion sensor and a camera. And usually it's a warm-blooded animal that'll trigger the motion sensor, the camera will start taking pictures. And these days it can take video, and typically we'll have infrared flash so that if it's at night, which is when, you know, really most animals are out moving around, they usually don't even really notice it's there. It's just that's why you get the black and white images at night, but it doesn't blind them like a white flash might.
No. In your book, Candid Creatures, How Camera Traps Reveal the Mysteries of Nature, you had some great luck. I'm not going to call it luck. You're very skilled at getting these.
Well, it wasn't me. I mean, some of my pictures are there, but I actually have contributions from 152 different scientists all around the world. I would basically read a cool science paper that found something interesting with camera traps and write the author and say, hey, would you be willing to share some pictures? And, you know, every camera trapper has a greatest hits folder of pictures on their computer, and people would graciously share these with me, and I'd pick, you know, the few best ones from that. So these are the highlights from, you know, what must be millions and millions of pictures that have been taken by scientists all around the world.
So you only have a tip of the iceberg of all the photos that they've sent you.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, most, you know, I picked the most exciting ones, either that were beautiful or that were really informative and telling. But, you know, the average camera trap will get pictures of, you know, a blurry squirrel that's running by or the butt of a deer that's walking by. And then mixed in there, you find the real gems of an animal sort of looking right at the camera, or a coyote carrying a squirrel in its mouth or something like that.
Yeah. How far back is this a hobby that goes back a ways?
It goes back a long ways, actually. Over 100 years back when it was, you know, big old cameras with sort of glass plates on these giant tripods and giant cakes of magnesium powder. And you couldn't sneak up on an animal with one of those in your hand. But people would leave them and then just tie a string to a piece of bait to the trigger. And that's how they would got the first camera trap pictures. And people were so struck by these. These were the first wildlife pictures ever printed in National Geographic magazine came from a camera trap.
Wow. These camera traps really tell stories. Tell us about the drama you saw when you set up your camera outside a fox den. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, sure. So I have a couple special camera traps that actually send me the images live through the cell phone network, which is a little bit more expensive, so I just have a couple of those. But we found, I was out with some students from North Carolina State University, and we found this hole in the ground. And sort of one of the most basic questions, well, I wonder what's using this hole. So we put this camera trap out, and we immediately got pictures of these two foxes visiting the den. And so we thought, hey, maybe this is it was springtime. Maybe they'll have babies. And then we saw the foxes bringing in prey. We saw them bringing in squirrels. Actually, on Easter morning, they brought in a bunny rabbit. And then we saw the puppies started coming out. But then we also had a coyote coming by. And coyotes are not the friend of foxes. They one time stole the rabbit that the parents had brought. And they're definitely a threat to the foxes. And we actually had this camera going again now in Raleigh. And this year they had two puppies. Now we only see one. So we're not quite sure what happened to the other one. But it's still unfolding. I'm going to go check again get an update probably later today.
No, we've actually got a video camera trap, your video camera trap, monitoring these foxes. I want to play some sound that our listeners can listen to. Let me play it, and then maybe you can tell us what we're hearing.
Sure.
What was that?
Yeah, so these video camera traps are great because you see in better resolution what's actually going on, and then you get this audio, which is this whole bonus. And I actually am not really sure what's going on in this. Maybe one of your callers knows foxes better, because in this video, you see it's the pup is in the hole, and it's looking up at its parent, and the parent is looking right down at it, and the pup is making these cacking noises. I'm thinking it might be some kind of begging sound, but it also sort of wonder if he's complaining about what his brother did to him down in the hole.
Oh, so that's not a mechanical noise, that clacking. That is the pup?
No, that's the pup. That's the pup talking to its mom.
Wow. If anybody knows what that is, give us a call, 844-SIP.
I have some other footage where they're... Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, let me just give out the number, 844-724-8255. Yeah. Even if you don't know what that is and you want to talk about this topic, 844-724-8255 is our number. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Go ahead. What were you about to say?
Well, we have some other footage of them begging, where clearly the pups are whining and begging, and they want the mom to give her food or to regurgitate food. Parents will regurgitate. So I've seen that. But that cackling sound, I'm not sure if that's just another kind of begging or some other interaction.
Right. I've got another sound bite that you gave us. Here's another clip from that video trap outside the foxhole. And then you tell us what it is. Wow.
That's a really great one. And I know exactly what that is, because what you hear in the background, that's the parent foxes barking. And I've heard that when I go change the battery, sometimes they'll bark at me and I try to get out of there as soon as I can. But in this case, the video camera trap was triggered by a coyote. He was right there at the den. He was trying to get into the den, but he was too fat to fit into the hole. This is the whole reason foxes are using the den, is to protect their pup. So the coyote is there trying to get in, and the mom or dad pup is off screen somewhere, and she's barking at him to try to get the coyote out of there. And then you can hear the coyote's footsteps as he runs away, chasing, you know, right up towards where that sound was, probably trying to chase the fox. So in this case, I guess it kind of worked. The fox got the coyote out of there by luring it away.
So you're not fearful of hanging out with the coyotes, I can see.
Well, we try to have as little impact as we can. We have to change the batteries every once in a while and get the memory chip sometimes. And so we get in there and out of there as fast as we can.
So what's the main lesson? What are scientists rigging up these camera traps? What are they trying to find out?
Well, all these animals are all around the world are dealing with increasing human presence. And some animals, like these red foxes, actually do pretty well around people. But a lot of other species don't, talking about, you know, rhinos and tigers and jaguars and some of these big animals that it's almost impossible to see these guys with your own eyes. So if we want to understand where they're surviving, where they're doing well, where they're doing poorly, and try to find solutions for how they can, how humans can figure out a way to coexist on the planet with these animals, we need this type of information. And camera traps are great for delivering what animal lives where, and then as a bonus, you get these beautiful pictures.
I have a tweet here, a little informational tweet from Judy, who says, please tell your wildlife biologist a fox puppy is called a kit.
Yeah, I hear that sometimes. Some people call it it's a canid, right? I've been calling them puppies. Some people call them kits. I don't know if there's some sort of panel that officially decides what the babies are called.
Okay. Where do I go from there? you did a camera trap experiment recently that involved a stuffed toy robot cat. This sounded wild. Explain what you did. What were you trying to find out?
Well, it was kind of wild. We were wondering what would attack a cat. And in particular, we had people tell us that fishers we're killing cats. And this is up in the Northeast where fishers are a big weasel or a small wolverine, depending on your perspective. And they're this wild animal that's a predator that has been recolonizing urban areas in the Northeast. This was up in Albany, New York, where we knew we had a lot of fishers. And we were wondering, would they actually kill a cat? And we'd been studying the fishers. We'd been following their footprints in the snow. We'd looked at their diet. And we didn't see any evidence that they actually were eating cats. But we thought, well, let's do an experiment and actually put a cat out there. And we didn't want to use a real cat. So we looked online to try to find the most realistic fake cat we could find. And it actually came at Toys R Us with this little robotic cat that would kind of meow and move around a little bit. So we put that out in the woods. We sprinkled some real cat hair out there to try to give it a real smell. And we never got a fisher coming around. We did get a coyote come and sniff it, and I think he must have smelled the batteries, and he didn't actually do anything with it. But this owl came down and landed in front of it, put up its wings, and then sunk its talons into the cat and tried to fly away with it. He didn't get too far, but he did fly with it right out of view. So it's evidence that definitely great horned owls are a threat to anybody's cat who is out in the woods at night.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's good. That's good to know. A lot of these photos that you have capture some pretty interesting animal behavior, like the tyra. Talk a little bit about that behavior.
Oh, the tyra study was great. This was some biologists who were down in Costa Rica, and they just glimpsed a tyra, which is actually a tyra similar to the fisher. It's a big weasel. It's in the rainforest. It's running around, and it had a plantain in its mouth. But it was a green plantain, so it wasn't ripe yet. And they thought, why would a tyra be carrying this fruit that it can't possibly eat now because it's not, you know, it's a unripe plantain is really bitter. So they started investigating more, and they put a camera trap on the plantain tree, and then they also put some radio transmitters in the green plantains to see what was happening. And they got a picture of this tyra ripping off these green plantains and then running away with it and hiding it under the leaves and basically caching it. And then it would come back and get it when it would ripen. So it was basically taking these so that the monkeys wouldn't get it later and hiding it. And it's an amazing amount of foresight for a wild animal like this to realize, to make this plan and to execute it. And it was caught in the act with a camera trap.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I'm talking with Roland Kays, author of Best of Camera Trap Pictures in his new book. He's got a great book, Candid Creatures, and all kinds of stuff in there. Let me go to the phone, see if we can get a phone call in from Mark in Big Island, Hawaii. Hi, Mark.
Hey, that's me. All right, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I had the most amazing adventure. It took about 4 months, but I'll cut right to the chase. I live on a 1 acre parcel where I have 130 cacao trees, cocoa, chocolate, you know, cacao. And, my neighbor has a manicured golf course lawn there, but it's all zoned ag. So the pigs, we've had this drought here, cause of El Nino, they have moved up into the neighborhoods and they're demolishing. Pigs are horrible animals for demolishing. They look for earthworms and whatnot. So, I started with snares. I got hold of a local contact, and he started me with passive snares, then active snares. And then for Christmas, my son-in-law got me a trail cam. I call it a trail cam. And it has various, it was good, it didn't have sound, but it had selective resolutions and durations and, you know, a lot of settings. Pretty high tech. And so I saw these pigs. There were several of them, but the one was the sow that really was bothering me. So I wasn't catching her with snares. So I got hold of a local boy with a legit trap. You know,
I'm running out of time, Mark. Did you capture it on your camera?
Yes. I got beautiful pictures of it. If you want to steer, I used it initially to look at anatomy because then I went to progress to a bow hunting, and I have no clue about what bow hunting was. But I got target practice, and I had anatomy pictures of her. Then I got tired of looking at that, and I gotta say
goodbye because we're running out of time. I'm sure it's a great story, and I'm sure maybe you'll get a picture of what he caught there, Roland. For your next book, you got to follow up?
Well, it's interesting because these camera traps or trail cameras, as he called them, are used quite a lot by hunters to try to figure out, you know, where the animals are that they're trying to hunt, whether it's a pest like this hog or during deer hunting season. So the biologists actually benefit quite a bit from the market that that hunters have created for camera traps, and all these companies are making newer and better camera traps, often for the hunters as much as for the biologists.
Roland Kays, Research Associate Professor at NC State University. Candid Creatures, How Camera Traps Reveal the Mysteries of Nature. Great book. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on.
And if you want to see a few of those candid creatures, you can go to our website. We've got a gallery of animal selfies, plus Julie Leibach's great article, Selfies from the Animal Kingdom. It's all on sciencefriday.com/cameras. And speaking of Animal Kingdom and camera traps, they are just one of the ways you can take a sample with our Science Club sampling project. Come and join the fun at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub. Take a sample, show off your success. You can tweet your samples with the hashtag #TakeASample in time for our wrap-up next week. One last thing before we go. This week we received the word of the death of Nobel Prize-winning chemist Sir Harry Kroto. He was a co-discoverer of the Buckminster fullerene, really by accident, serendipity as he called it, while trying to study the chemistry of carbon molecules in distant stars. And when Sir Harry spoke with us in Tallahassee back in 2009, he made the case for basic research of the kind that produced his buckyballs.
So in a sense, it's the fundamental science looking at the way the world works, which brings the surprise they didn't expect. We need funding for fundamental science because out of that fundamental science, the unexpected discoveries lead to the massive breakthroughs. And if you're only looking at applications and strategic things, you leave this other area of very important ones behind.
Sir Harry Kroto, dead at the age of 76. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. On the web this week, we have a story about a group that's using 3D laser scanning to build a digital archive of the world's monuments, from Mount Rushmore to the Parthenon. Check it out at sciencefriday.com. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. Have a great weekend.